seems like. I'd given you some study work to look at the book of Mark. If you are new with us, just remind you what we're doing Wednesday nights is we're doing a survey of the Bible. We finished the Old Testament before the new year, picked up the New Testament last month, and so we take pretty much each week and do about a book at a time. We're going to mix it up here a little bit, and I'll tell you about that later, but taking about a book at a time, going through the New Testament, should finish that this summer, all right? So we're to the book of Mark, and I told you before, I said your homework was to read through the book of Mark and try and find his connecting word. There's a significant connecting word that Mark repeats over and over and over again through his gospel. So anybody in your research come across one of Mark's favorite words in his gospel? The word immediately, yes. Mark is an action-packed dude. That word immediately just means right now, right here, on the spot. I mean, it happens quick. And that is kind of the format. When you read the Gospel of Mark, he is not writing for necessarily a specific instruction, a specific group of people trying to convey a singular message. He's just recounting about the life and work of Christ. And we'll talk about how it kind of fits together. But he's very focused on the action part, what Jesus did, his teachings, his miracles, his signs. There's a lot of movement in the book of Mark, and he's very short to the point. Tells you what it is, moves to the next thing. Tells you what it is, moves to the next thing. And it's interesting, the part I love about looking at the Gospel of Mark is understanding who he is. Getting to know him as an author and how he came to have his gospel is what really helps you look at his book and go, wow, that's pretty cool. Now I kind of see how it all comes together and why it comes together in this way. So getting to know him starts in the book of Acts chapter 12. He's one of the gospel writers that we get a little bit more background and history, even honestly, than some of the apostles. We know some of their professions and things that they did, but we're able to watch John Mark because he's referenced and he's taught about it some other places, so we get some background on him, which help us then know how he came to write the gospel. So the author's name is Mark, and he is referenced in numerous places throughout the New Testament as the name John Mark, the guy with two first names, right? You've met those guys, got two first names. So John Mark is the name he's referenced as. The dating of his book generally is put in the late 50s, but you can make some arguments up through the mid-60s, no later than the 70 AD when the Romans came in and destroyed the temple, which Jesus had predicted, because if it's pretty commonly thought and understood that if he had been alive and writing his book after that had happened, he would have tied that to Jesus saying it was going to happen. But he makes no mention of that. Therefore, his book was written before the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD when the Romans came to town. A lot of the conversation around dating is primarily going to happen based on the idea of how Mark may have influenced Matthew and Luke. We talked before about the synoptic gospels that Matthew, Mark, and Luke all convey a large part of the same information. They tell some of the same stories. They have a general same chronological timeline for Jesus' life. And so people look at that and go, oh, well, they overlap. They match a whole lot. They must have borrowed from each other on their material. And so to do that, then you say, well, who was written first? You know, Matthew and Luke share a lot of Mark's information, so he must have been written first. We know that Luke was writing at this time window because of arrest and imprisonment and things that he references. So if Luke came after Mark, Mark had to be first. So he kind of put him in the 50s. But then you get to the other part and say, but if they didn't have to rely on each other, then it could have been in the 60s. A whole lot of conversation around it. And here's the basic thing when it comes down to this. They're writing about the same event. They're writing under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. Therefore, they're going to write about the same general chronological timeline of Jesus' life. Of course the information is going to overlap because they're writing about the same event. And the fact that the timeline fits is no different than if you go to 8 different publishers who write about American history. They're going to put the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, World War I, World War II, Vietnam War, and the Gulf War in what order? The order I just named them. Why are they going to do that? Because that's the order they happened in, all right? I mean, they're kind of telling that story. So generally, Mark falls in the late 50s, but you can make an argument either way. Acts chapter 12 is where we meet Mark, get to know a little bit about him. Acts chapter 12 is when the apostle Peter has been imprisoned. The angel comes, sets him free in the middle of the night. Verse 12, Peter thought he was having a dream. It says when he realized this, realized that he was actually free from prison, he wasn't just having a dream, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark. So his mother was a wealthy individual, it's believed, who had this house church that met there in Jerusalem. It says where many were gathered together and were praying. So a sizable estate. His mother was Mary, was a believer, was a part of the early church. And who's the disciple who comes to the house? Peter. So Peter was closely associated with the family, so closely associated that this is the story where the servant girl comes to the door and Peter knocks and says, "It's me, let me in." And she runs back to the people and says, "Hey, Peter's at the front door." And they're like, "No, it's just his spirit who came over because we're praying for him." You know, the kind of that thing where we're praying for something and we don't have faith enough to believe that what we're praying for actually happened. You know, and they're like, "No, it's not him." And they're like, "Wait a minute, you prayed for something. The answer is at your front door, and you're not acknowledging it that's there." You ever been through one of those things, praying for something, and God provides the answer? Like, "Oh, it can't be that easy." Well, yeah, that's how God works sometimes. So they recognize Peter. Peter comes in and continues on through that. But John Mark wasn't just associated with his mom as a young believer that apparently the apostles, particularly the apostle Peter, some of the other apostles come through, are familiar with this house church, with some individuals who are here, pick up to begin mentoring John Mark. So in Acts chapter 15, if you'll flip over there a couple of pages to your right, verse 36 says, "After some days, Paul said to Barnabas, 'Let us return and visit the brothers in every city where we proclaim the word of the Lord and see how they are.' Now Barnabas wanted to take with him John, called Mark." So here we see the same young man. Barnabas' connection to Mark was that he was his cousin. The book of Colossians, it references that Mark was his cousin. Barnabas wanted to take along Mark, verse 38. "But Paul thought best not to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work." So what had happened was on a previous missionary journey, Mark had gone with Paul and Barnabas, going city to city, sharing Christ, planting churches, leading people, discipling, strengthening the believers. Well, somewhere in that trip at Pamphylia, something happened. Whether it was homesickness, whether it was illness, whether it was whatever, you know, happened, Mark went back home. He left. I was like, I got to head back home. I'm bailing out on you guys. And then he begged off of the trip. What ticked Paul off? I mean, you think about Paul. He's Mr. Go get him, put your nose in, let's go. I've been beaten this many times. I've been stoned. I've been shipwrecked. I've been whatever. You know, no cost is too great. So whatever it was that caused Mark to leave, to go back, Paul thought he wimped out on him, basically, and he didn't like it, and he didn't want to give him the second chance to go on another missionary journey. Verse 39, "And there arose a sharp disagreement so that they separated from each other. Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas and departed, having been commended by the brothers to the grace of the Lord." So see, we have the early Baptists right here. They can't get along, and so they divide. All right, so you get First Baptist, and then you get Second Baptist, and then you get Unity Baptist and Fellowship Baptist, and you just start all these because, you know, they're going different paths here, different directions. But they do separate and divide. But here's the thing. When over time, as John Mark continues to grow, as we all do in our relationship, our walk with Christ, as Paul matures, gets a little more seasoned in his faith, in his understanding of God's plan and God's purposes and how God uses people, both of them change. Mark continues to grow in maturity. Paul becomes more seasoned. Later in his ministry, if you look at the book of, you don't have to turn there now, but if you want to write down the reference, 2 Timothy chapter 4, Paul at the end of his ministry actually calls for and sends for and says, "Someone bring Mark to come and see me because he's become very valuable to me in the ministry. So over time, Mark won back Paul's appreciation, his respect, and Paul wanted him to come and be with him while he is a suffering and he's serving the Lord. So, you know, it really kind of shows this full circle here. Paul wanted nothing to do with him, but by the end of his life later in his ministry, he was wanting Mark to come because Mark had established himself. He continued on growing in the faith. And so, you know, a big part of this, I love to have that history, that context about Mark, because it's such an encouragement to me. Because I don't know about you guys, but there are the times when I kind of fall short. I don't get where I want to go or feel like God's called me to go, and I wimp out. You know, I bail out on things. I don't, you know, stick to it, and I kind of get aggravated and frustrated at myself, and, you know, what am I going to do? And, you know, I've let God down again. He can't use somebody like me, but God continues to work, and God continues to give us second chances. God continues to bring people into our lives to develop us and challenge us and help us grow and mature so that God can use us for His kingdom and for His glory and for His honor. And so, I love just knowing a little bit about Mark's history, and it's cool to be able to pick all these things up. The other part of it is that, okay, well, how did Mark come to write the gospel? He wasn't an apostle. He wasn't necessarily the firsthand eyewitness of Christ. And so how did he get all of his information? Well, our understanding of how he came to get his information comes primarily from the early church fathers. Early on, as the church was being established, and we're talking now into the early 100s, into the 200s, there were church leaders who were taking the writings of the early apostles and other books that were out there. They were beginning to determine what was actual true scripture, what wasn't true scripture. They were helping begin to organize and structurally bring together the church and church structure. Structures and organizations. And one of the early church fathers, Papias, tells us how Mark came to write his gospel. And he says this, and I'm just going to read this quote. It's kind of long, but I'll kind of stop and fill in some stuff from his first century language. It says, "And the presbyter," meaning the apostle John, "said this, Mark having become the interpreter of Peter." So Mark, remember this connection with Peter coming to his house when his mother was there. Mark spent a lot of time with Peter and is referenced as his interpreter. He becomes the scribe. Peter's talking. Peter's telling what goes on. And Mark begins to write and collect these things. It says he wrote down accurately whatsoever he remembered. It was not, however, in exact order that he related the sayings or deeds of Christ. So we have this reference, and Mark was telling people. Now here's stuff about Jesus. It's not necessarily in the right order. So that's kind of an important thing when you're thinking about Mark and then Matthew and Luke, who borrowed from who. Mark says, hey, I'm just putting them all together, not necessarily the way they happened. But here's how he got his stuff. It says, "For he neither heard the Lord nor accompanied him, but afterwards, as I said, he accompanied Peter, who accommodated his instructions to the necessity of his hearers." Now, what that means is this. John Mark traveled with Peter, and as Peter was teaching people, he would tell them what was pertinent, what was relevant for the situation that they were dealing with. Oh yeah, we were out somewhere, and here's what Jesus did. Here's what Jesus said, and Peter would tell them what Jesus said in that moment. He would be with another group of people, or another topic would come up. Oh yeah, Jesus told us one time, here's what he said to do. So Peter is teaching people real life situations, real context of questions and answers and things that they're going through. And Peter just tells them based on his experiences, his times with Christ. And John Mark hears all this. So as Peter's nears the end of his life, time comes, Mark writes down these things that he had heard Peter tell as he was teaching other people about Jesus. He says, "Mark made no mistake in thus writing some things as he remembered them, for of one thing he took especial care, not to omit anything that he had heard and not to put anything fictitious into the statements." And so this is an early church father who had spoken to the Apostle John, who said, this is the book that Mark wrote, and here's how and why Mark wrote it. So his testimony is about that. And remember too, when you're dealing with books that are written in the 50s and 60s, Jesus was crucified around what time window? Around 30, you know, 31, 32 AD, somewhere in there. So you're talking less than 20 years. The reason that's significant is because that's enough time. If somebody writes down, makes a claim that didn't happen, someone's going to raise their hand and say, no, 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 I was there. That didn't go down that way, didn't happen like that. So these books are written very early on when there's plenty of eyewitness testimony to refute it if it wasn't true. But you know what? They didn't get refuted, because they were true. These were true accounts of what happened. So that's kind of the background of Mark. And like I said, I just love picking all that stuff up because it helps us kind of understand a little bit about him. Now, here's another little trivia question for you in your study. See how much you studied if you caught this, if you read through the book. Many commentators think Mark is referenced in his own gospel. Other than just in general as a people. Anybody know the account or the place that possibly Mark referenced himself as appearing in the gospel he wrote? Ooh, Bible trivia. Like, who was the father of the first judge or something like that? Not that I've been reading and stalking your Facebook post or anything, Tom, so. What?
He's a naked man.
The naked man. How many of you knew that there was a naked man in the book of Mark? You say what? Mark chapter 14. And a young man followed him. I'm sorry. Mark chapter 14. I better give you a verse reference. Verse 51. Mark 14, 51. This is in the garden right after the betrayal, the arrest of Jesus. It says, and a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body. And they seized him, but he left the linen cloth and ran away naked. Many commentators think that that's Mark who's trying to not embarrass himself any more than he needs to by leaving his name out of that. He omits, for his own discretion's sake there, the fact that that's him. So what questions does that bring up in your mind about a person following around in a linen cloth that runs away naked?
Well, they've been sleeping and resting, and not staying awake at the watch.
Right? The disciples had been? Okay.
Yes. And maybe he happened to be there with them and just was sleeping with very little on.
Okay.
Well, it's right under the betrayal and arrest of Jesus.
That wasn't what you really asked, huh?
No, I'm just kind of saying, where does this fit in anything, and how would it be Mark, and what questions, you read this and go, all right, got a couple of questions here.
I said it's under the betrayal and arrest of Jesus, so I don't know why he's wearing a linen cloth, but he might have got scared because they said he sees that he got scared.
Okay. Yeah, a lot of people got...
Because of the Passover?
A lot of people were scared and ran away. What'd you say?
Because of the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper.
Oh, keep...
Was it Mark's mom's house?
Oh, what? What?
That was where he had the Last Supper.
Oh.
House. That was why you could just tell the guys, just go in there and they'll have it all arranged and... Yeah.
All right, we're totally in the realm of speculative theory here, all right? So let's acknowledge that. We don't know. But part of the conversation is that possibly the Last Supper was at Mary's house. You remember from Acts chapter 12, they're in Jerusalem, the big you know, arrangement, all this. The other part, now remember, Mark said that he wasn't an apostle, you know, and hadn't traveled with Jesus. So what's it tell you about maybe age context here? He's a youngster. So when you think about kids, mom's had a big thing over these guys that you hear about this Jesus and you're curious watching this, but you're not invited in, you know, you're not a part of it as a young man. And so this whole idea of the linen cloth and somebody being naked. Well, first of all, you know, understand they didn't wear the layers of clothes that we wear with all that stuff. All right. So that wasn't a cultural sort of thing. But you kind of see a little boy watching what's happening and a part of a group kind of to go along with, you know, just there with the crowds and then getting caught up and running back and being in it. So, you know, there's some possibility of that. Trivia and rabbits we chase when we study the Gospels. All right, so that part of it. Had you ever heard that theory of conversation? So now your life is enriched. You know who you. Yeah. You know. You know a possible identity of the naked man in Mark chapter 14. The other thing too, well, we'll pick this up in a second. The purpose of Mark's book And if you look back in the author, recognize him. When he writes his book, it's not to a Jewish audience. No genealogy in the book of Mark. Part of it is like, you know what? I'm not writing to Jewish people. They're not real big on that whole Jewish heritage. I'm not going to prove anything or win anything to them in that. Doesn't spend a lot of time talking about the religious groups, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, any of those sort of things. The Roman Gentile believers. His book was likely written in the area of Rome. Big discussion on all that, but if that's the case, he's writing to Gentile Romans. Jewish stuff, that history, totally removed from them. So he just kind of writes in a language they can understand, the Greek that's there, but also we see a couple of cues in his book when he would use an Aramaic word as you're reading through Mark, and if you want to write this on the side of your overview there. When you see the phrase "that is" or "that meant" and there's an interpretation, he takes a common language spoken of the everyday Greek of the Jewish people and he translates it for his Roman audience who's reading it. What that says is he writes a word in there and he's like, they're not going to know what that word means. The word means, and then he gives the definition, the translation of that. So he's writing for an audience and he's thinking about them going, I want to help them understand this. So he's looking for hurdles, for barriers, things that might be confusing, so we can clarify it for them. So he's writing to these Roman Gentiles, unfamiliar with Jewish customs, but the goal of his book and his writing is to convince people that Jesus was truly the Messiah, God's Son, who was sent, and he wanted them to believe that so they would trust Christ, give their life to Him, and grow as disciples, as followers, as learners that would be fleshed out in their actions, in their behavior. Again, focus of Mark's book is on actions. It's on the doing part. So his call, his challenge, is for those who profess Christ to live that out in their lives as well. You see a couple of the key verses there. Let's look at chapter 10, Mark chapter 10. And the first of the themes and theologies that you see there, Mark leans into the humanity of the disciples. All of them, particularly Peter, though, is a point of emphasis. Why would you think that would be the case?
Because he denied Christ, and that was a very human thing, facing fear, and yet he went on to do great things, as we know in Acts.
Which one, Peter?
Yes.
Part of that's the case. But remember how did Mark come to write his book? Why would he particularly give us some human-type details about Peter?
Himself.
Okay, Peter was a man of action.
Peter was his source.
So he's hearing from Peter. Peter's telling him from his firsthand experience. Therefore, when you get some of the details about Peter, then you're going to kind of get it from Peter's viewpoint. And Peter was pretty open and candid on, man, I botched it and what's going on here. We'll pick some of that up. But in Mark 10, verse 13, and they were bringing children to him that he might touch them, and the disciples rebuked them. It's one of those things where you kind of cringe and go, oh, why was I doing that? You know, they thought they were doing the good thing, the right thing, keeping the crowds away. Verse 14, but when Jesus saw it, he was indignant and said to them, even notice the word indignant. When you read through John's gospel, look for emotional type words. Look for the human characterizations of stuff. He gives us a picture, vivid pictures of Jesus' humanity that we don't see in some of the other gospels. I mean, he's just very candid that Jesus had compassion. Jesus was angry. Here with the disciples, it says he was indignant toward them. It's that, you know, he was, you know, frustrated. Guys, what are you doing? You know, there's a rebuke that comes toward the disciples. We see Jesus rebuking here in a moment. So he's indignant and said to them, let the little children come to me. Do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of God. Truly I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God like a child shall not enter it. And he took them in his arms and blessed them, laying his hands on them. So the disciples didn't want the kids to come so that they could be touched by Jesus. And Jesus at the end, there's a very important note here. Again, this humanity of Mark, the action of Mark, that Jesus hugged him and he laid his hands on him. There was this touch, there was this blessing that we see in that. And so that's one of the key verses there. Another here, let's see, where are we? Verse 45 of Mark chapter 10. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. The Son of Man as a servant of God is a very common theme that you'll see in the book of Mark. He really goes to that servanthood, that Jesus touching, that ministering, that being with people, the touching of lepers. When you read that, that's always significant because nobody wanted to touch a leper. You know, you stayed away from them. That was part of their stigma in society. And so the fact that Jesus touched and was very sensory, hands-on, is repeated over and over again throughout Mark's gospel. So here, number one, themes in theology, the humanity of the disciples. Look at Mark chapter 8. And we talked about particularly some of the Peter stuff. Let's look at a couple things here related to Peter. Chapter 8. Verse 31, and he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." So imagine, again, Peter's talking to crowds, to John Mark, telling his perspective of what happened here. You know, this is one of the things that people point to as a verifier of the truthfulness of Scripture, because Scripture paints the warts and all of people. You know, it is human nature, I think. You all can verify this. We try to paint ourselves in the best possible light, don't we? I mean, don't we always give ourselves the benefit of the doubt? And if we're, you know, we're in something and we've got to defend our side, we kind of will leave out parts of the information, or we'll, add to, the other person's responsibility in this. My kids are masters at this. They are amazing at being able to shift blame and not take responsibility. And you know why they're good at it? Because they've learned from the best. All right, they've learned from the best how to be able to do that. But that's human nature. But one of the things that you look at when you look through the Bible is, man, everything is there. We see not just the strengths and the glowing reports and people that got it right. We see those who blew it big time. And here's one of these with Peter where Jesus rebukes him and says, "Get behind me, Satan." You're like, oh, man. If I'm Peter, I'm saying, yeah, Jesus wasn't happy with what I said and he told me not to say it. You know, but Peter's like, no, he said, "Get behind me, Satan." And he told me, I was thinking about the ways of his ways and not my own plans. And so we see that coming out. Mark chapter 9, the Mount of Transfiguration. Jesus is there. Elijah shows up with Moses. They're talking with Jesus. Verse 5, Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." Look at verse 6. For he didn't know what to say, for they were terrified. You know, who's making that comment? That's Peter saying, you know why I said that? I was scared to death. I didn't know what to say. So I just said, "Let's make some tents and set up for you guys to be up here." And that's not what we did. So, I mean, you just kind of hear Peter coming through, conveying these things to Mark as he goes through. Mark chapter 14. Mark chapter 14. Into that chapter. It's a long chapter. Verse 71. But he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, "I do not know this man of whom you speak." That's Peter. And what just happened right there? That was his third denial of Christ. And again, if I'm Peter conveying the story, I'm going to say, "And I let him down three times and I just didn't do, you know, I denied him." But Peter gives the detail here. He invoked curses and he swore, and you know, he swore, you know, in this. I mean, this is using foul language to be able to emphatically make his point of the fact that he didn't know Jesus. I mean, just the candor of Peter conveying to Mark, "Man, I blew it. I absolutely blew it. Totally, you know, denied Christ. And I didn't just say I didn't know him. I went above and beyond. And so he's just candid about this. Verse 72, immediately the rooster crowed a second time. Peter remembered how Jesus said to him, before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times. And he broke down and wept. So again, you see this remorse that's there. But Mark got his information from who?
Peter.
Mark bailed out on Paul's missionary journey. Paul ready to wash his hands of him. Mm-hmm. Who was a mentor, a teacher, a trainer, an example to Mark? Peter. He'd watch Peter. Who, of all the disciples, of all the people who could say, man, you're going to fall short, you're going to blow it, you're going to not be where you need to be, do what you need to do. But man, I'm telling you, Jesus will forgive you. He will love you. He will give you a second chance, a do-over. And He can take and redeem your shortcomings, your mistakes, and do great things in you and through you. Who better to convey that message than Peter? And Mark had heard it. He watched Peter. He listened to this. And he saw Peter in the book of Acts, where God did use him in a tremendous way. So, you know, thinking about that in the context of Mark disappointing the Apostle Paul, not wanting him to be going on that second missionary journey, but remembering, hey, God can take, God can redeem, and I'm going to continue to pursue Him even though I made the mistakes in the past. This humanity that really begins to come out through Peter and the disciples. Jesus' emotions, we see things of His anger. I mentioned that earlier. So we just see the realness, the authenticity of Jesus through Mark's gospel. I already mentioned the word immediately used 39 times throughout Mark's gospel. He focused on action more than the teaching, but also the word immediately helps convey the power of Jesus. The hard-hitting, you know, story after story, the incident after incident in Jesus' life is to remind us, the reader, that Jesus is powerful and that when He works immediately, and it's full and it's complete when it happens. And so the idea here of the miracles and His use of the word immediately isn't that, oh, somebody was sick and Jesus said, okay, you're going to get better, and He left town and a month later they got better, so you're going, well, did Jesus heal them or did they really get better? Like, no, immediately. That, you know, He spoke this and immediately it happened. It was the power of God working through Christ. So we see this this energy that comes with it. Number four, Jesus as the servant. And then Mark includes more references in other places, the messianic secret. You ever heard that? What do you think of when you hear or see the two words messianic secret?
The secret that He didn't come in like a Messiah king, but instead He came in as a Messiah lamb, savior of all.
Okay.
That's not the right answer.
No, you're in there.
Close but no cigar.
What's a secret? Something you don't tell, all right? Well, let's look at a couple of these then.
Something you only tell your closest friends.
Or something you only tell your closest friends. Yeah, that's right. Mark chapter 1. Let's look at a couple of these. Mark chapter 1. Verse 32, that evening at sundown they brought to Him all who were sick or oppressed by demons. And while the whole city was gathered together at the door, and He healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons, and He would not permit the demons to speak because they knew Him.
They knew He was the Son of God.
Why does that matter? Why would He not want them to speak and say that? Well, there you go. Let's look at the next one here. verse 44. Let's back up. Verse 40. And a leper came to Him, imploring Him, kneeling, said to Him, if You will, You can make me clean. Move with pity. There's that pity. Remember emotion words you read through? Move with pity. So we see this emotion of Jesus. Stretched out His hand and touched Him and said to Him, I will be clean. And immediately the leprosy left Him and He was made clean. And Jesus sternly charged Him. Another kind of emotional, the stern is in the, it's a tone of the voice thing. My kids know when the tone of voice, Dad's being stern on the command, and it means to stop now, not 10 minutes from now. Jesus sternly charged him and sent him away at once and said to him, see that you say nothing to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded for a proof to them. yes?
Was it because then the Jewish people will make him king? It was that political moment that they were waiting for the confirmation, something like that. And he was avoiding that. He was more concentrated on his mission as redeeming humankind.
I'm just asking the questions. I don't know the answers.
Why'd you ask?
It's group discovery. We're learning together.
Correct.
So we can say, did that have to do with the size of the crowds following him or something like that? Because I thought that I've read that in there before when he asked them not to speak about it.
Okay. Look at verse 44. But he went out and began to talk freely about it. So the guy didn't keep the secret very well. And to spread the news so that Jesus could no longer openly enter a town, but was out in desolate places and people were coming to him from every quarter. So you see what happened. Look at verse 35 of Mark chapter 1. And rising very early in the morning while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place where he prayed. So we see that prayer from Jesus. I think it's, let me see where I'm at here. I think it's Mark. I'm not finding where it's referenced. But Mark is the one I think who tells us that Jesus would very often withdraw with his disciples to desolate places and would pray. So he kind of gives us note here. So the messianic secret is a little bit of what a couple of you have said here, is that Jesus was the Messiah. But he came not as the Messiah the Jewish people were expecting. They were looking for a political ruler who was going to come in and say, I'm God's chosen leader, you're God's chosen people, we're going to be the world superpower, let's go. Bring it on, we'll defeat all comers to the table. So that's what they were looking for. Jesus didn't... Yeah, still waiting for it, some of them are. That's right, they're still waiting for that, that's right. So Jesus like, that's not the kind of Messiah, that's not the kind of ruler I've come to be. And so to say, I'm the Messiah, I'm the chosen one, well, how do we know that? Well, watch these signs and miracles. Boom, boom, boom. They go, oh, you are the Messiah. Then let's have the political thing. Let's make you the king, the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, the ticker tape parade. People thinking, oh, the Messiah has come. He's here. He's finally showing his hand. You know, he's revealing he's the Messiah. But then a couple of days later, he's dead. So people are going, well, that wasn't him. If you're going to be the Messiah to lead us, to lead the world, you don't die at the hands of Roman soldiers for this. And so Jesus was protecting the Messiah because he knew that when the word got out and the signs were there to verify, very likely the people would then move in that direction. But the other element of this is that every time the signs and the wonders happened, many people, large crowds, came to follow Jesus. They wanted to be there to eat the food, to see the signs and wonders, to get the blessing, to have, you know, what would happen. And Jesus wasn't able to move about freely. Or what did Jesus very often do when the crowds got large?
He withdrew.
He would withdraw, which is part of what he would do. But what else?
Go on a boat.
Oh, he'd get on a boat. He would say something to thin the crowds out. That's exactly right. People are coming for the show and for fighting. He says, take up your cross and follow me. Like, the cross, you'd die, you know. What's that mean? If anyone comes after me and doesn't hate his mother, his father, his brother, and his sister, then he can't be my follower. What do you mean? I got to, you know, not love my family? The rich young ruler. Go sell everything you have. Give to the poor. Come follow me. So people are like, well, what in the world? And so, yeah, when the crowds would get too big, he would up the commitment to follow him, and many would fall away. Jesus wasn't after the crowd. He wasn't after the show and the pomp and circumstance. He wanted heart followers, true disciples, which is what Mark drives to. And he kind of reminds us several times with this messianic secret that Jesus was there for people to surrender their hearts and lives to him and begin living in his power and in his presence to accomplish glory for him and for his kingdom.
Why did he instruct so many times throughout the Gospels, don't tell anyone, for that same reason? What you just said?
All of those reasons we just said. Yes, it was to not have people begin to pick their own agenda and try and force Jesus into it. It was, I've come, I've done this, I'm going to work out and do what God's called me to do as a servant of God, obeying him, and I'm not going to be manipulated or forced by crowds, popular opinion, any of this kind of stuff into it. And the followers that I'm looking for, I want to be true, genuine people who believe because they believe the truth that's spoken, not because they saw a sign, a wonder, a miracle, proof thing along those lines. That make sense? You tracking with me? All right, very good. Okay, let's flip to the section of controversy in Mark's Gospel, Mark chapter 16. Mark 16. Got this note a couple weeks ago from someone. Somebody sent me a Facebook message, and before I even got a chance to respond, some others jumped in and taken care of it. But just as a note and a reference, if you're reading through an ESV Bible translation, if you're reading a NIV Bible translation, there will be places that you will see verses missing in the order of the verses that go through. You'll be like, it goes to 27, and then it's 29, or it's 30. What happened to this? Well, why is this not in here? Look at the Lord's Prayer in some of these, and you're like, it doesn't include the last little part in there, where to go, and somebody's monkeying with the Bible, and they're not interpreting it right, and they're going to hell because of it kind of stuff. And so you get all this, and somebody had said, why are these verses missing out of the Bible? Where'd they go kind of thing? And generally, the primary text that people compare to is the King James Version. You'll get that a lot, and that's one of the a staunch reason that people are King James only. It's because it's got all the verses in it. It's what they say. It's got all the verses in there because these other ones are missing that. So I'm not a King James only person. I grew up on King James. I cut my teeth. I memorized a ton of scriptures as a King James kid. So sometimes I have like a Curtis translation because it'll be part King James with a little NIV from my youth ministry years with some ESV thrown in there. So it kind of becomes a hybrid. You're like, what did he just say? It's not in any of my Bible translations. I'm kind of morphing it all together. But we've talked about this a couple times, but just wanted to refresh your memory because it's very applicable to Mark's gospel here, is as time has progressed since the King James was written in 1611. 1611 being how long ago? A long time, yeah. a long time before now. There were manuscripts. There were texts of the Bible that were in existence then. They had a few, and so they translated, and they got a great Bible, and they put it in the hands of the common English people. And millions of people came to know Christ through King James. It's wonderful. I'm so thankful for the movement to get it in the hands of the common people in the common language. As time goes on, discoveries are made, archaeological discoveries, advancements in our study of language or understanding of language because of other documents. And as this happened over time, we came to a point where we found some manuscripts of books of the Bible. And these are rough numbers. I've not looked at the stats recently. It's, you know, statistics are always changing, and they say that they make up 80% of statistics anyway, so... yeah, it bothered me that. But like when you're looking at evidence on biblical authority, there are roughly 22,000 remnants, fragments, pieces of the Bible that are in existence. And when I say, a remnant, some people think, oh, it's like two verses. I mean, it'll be a whole book of the Bible. But 22 various remnants, pieces, parts of biblical manuscripts from millennia. I mean, we're talking long, you know, originals in the 50s, 60s, and, you know, hundreds dated in there. I mean, we've got the originals. And the amazing thing is, when you compare all of these, they all have the same thing in them. They're very, very close in what they say, the order, the wording, the phrasing, because biblical scholars were very thorough in sitting down and writing and making sure they copied the appropriate things as they went through. So very, very close, 22,000 remnants. I believe the next highest number of ancient manuscript books we have are Homer's Iliad. Is that right? Somebody follow me here. It's Homer's Iliad. And the number of existent copies, fragments that remain of this, take a stab at it.
100. 150. You look like you're waiting for some more. 50.
4,000. The last number I saw was around 8. I think it was a high 700s, around 800 copies of this. So here's my point in this. That's a whole bunch, and that's not many. Nobody in the world, in secular realms, society, culture, doubts the accuracy of Homer's Iliad. Like, okay, yeah, so we got enough copies, we're fine. Yet we have 22,000 copies that are all say the same thing or similar, that, you know, have this, and they go, oh, we just can't trust the Bible. It's not true. There's not enough information to be trusted. It's like, dude, what do you got to do? What's your threshold to be able to convince you of this? But in those 22,000 parts, some of the manuscripts that we find, some verses aren't there. And we're able to date because of other writings and reference materials dating kings and cities and things like that. We know that it's older than some of the copies that we already had. And so we go back and we look and we're like, oh, those verses, that verse isn't in this part of it. So what happened? Don't. Yes. Homer's Iliad is a book.
Is it like a Bible?
No, it's Greek mythology sort of thing, I believe. It's the story of a hero who goes out and goes to war and accomplishes certain things, but it's from ancient times, 400s, 480, something like that. It's a pretty common piece of literature work for the size and volume and the storytelling at that period of time. So it's an ancient historical work that still exists today that people say, oh, it's a great piece of literature from then. And we can trust it that it was true and he wrote it and all that. So that comparison. That make sense? Okay. So we're just talking about the fragments. Why some copies would be missing a verse or have something in or something not in there. Okay, so in the copying, maybe you miss a part. That happens. Yes?
Do you think it was that important, maybe?
What's that now?
Do you think it's that important or relevant?
Okay, if it was an important or relevant part. And sometimes, some writings, people would add in editorial comments. They would say, and this still exists today, or this city is now called. So you get a little clarifying thing, because 100 years later, people need, they don't understand the same reference point. So possibly you get an editorial thing. Say you get an editor's comment that was written in 200 A.D., well, then you find a manuscript that was dated around 89 A.D., and it doesn't have this verse in there. Well, we were using this one. Well, this was the editorial comment that came into it right here. Okay? Think through a little bit how we got the Gospel of Mark. He heard from
Peter.
And what did Mark say about what he heard from Peter? May not be in the same order. He tried to remember it as accurately as he could. So like the Lord's Prayer, for example, going through that part of it there, as it's written down and you've got, you know, the last part of it. You know, Matthew may have not remembered that portion, but another of the other apostles, as they're teaching, go through the Lord's Prayer and they say, oh, and he said this. And if you'd ask Matthew's, oh yeah, I forgot about that part. But, you know, it wasn't in there, but later from the other inclusions of it, it gets in there. So again, got the older manuscripts. So just walking through and understanding that, to tell you as you read through an ESV or an NIV Bible, sometimes you'll see those verses not in there, or a lot of times the ESV will try and bracket them. They'll put a little bracket so you can know that, hey, this may have not been included. Or if it's ever missing in the text, go to the footnotes. They will always include it, even if they didn't put it in their main text. It's going to be in the footnotes of that part of the Bible. I say all that part to say at the end of Mark, there's a hotly debated passage of Scripture as to whether or not it's actually supposed to be in the Bible as part of Mark's Gospel. And here's what happened. And this is the reason it's debated and a little bit confusing. Some of the early church fathers, I mentioned them earlier, we're talking late first century, before you get to the hundreds. That's called the late what? The late first? Okay, into the first century. So some of those church fathers, they make no mention of these verses. And these are guys who are basically doing early commentary. Like they're going every chapter of the book that's written, the stories that are there, and they're writing some details out. Some of these early church fathers around, you know, the hundreds, they're making no reference to this. People go, oh, it wasn't in there, because these guys are very thorough and they don't say anything about it. So they must have not known that they existed. Some of the manuscripts, it's not written in some manuscripts dated in this around this time frame. So the argument is, well, that's not in there. However, in about the same time period, other respected, reputable, known church historians reference, and they mention these last verses in Mark's gospel. Same time window that's there.